We got Baxter Black waiting for us on the other end of this, so we better. Okay, our next speaker is Dr. Dan Grooms, Michigan State University. I think we're very fortunate to have Dan as well as all the speakers here. Their resumes are very strong in regards to DDD control, DDD research, and as well as biosecurity. Dan received his DDM at Ohio State University in 1989. He was in private practice in Ohio for 5 years. He's currently an associate professor in large animal clinical sciences department at Michigan State University, where he spends a lot of his time in preventive disease control strategies, particularly DDD and a few other diseases in the state of Michigan. He's a nationally known speaker as well with his experience and knowledge about DDD virus. So he's going to be speaking to us today about the role of vaccination in control of DDD virus. So we'll turn the floor over to Dan.
Thanks, Phil. Everybody can hear me okay? We're gonna roll right along here because we have a pretty tight time schedule, and I only have 20 minutes to talk about vaccination. And usually when I talk to my students at MSU, we spend a whole hour on this, so we're going to really condense this down into a short period of time. This is basically what I'm going to talk about in the next 20 minutes. I'm going to give you a very brief overview of the types of vaccines that we have available for this virus, and then kind of my feelings on the role of vaccines in the whole overall control program for DDD. And I think then Dr. Larson will try to pull all this together, the surveillance programs, the vaccination programs, the biosecurity that's all needed to really have a good control program for DDD. So this is going to be our goal right here. First of all, you should all be aware that there's lots of DDD vaccines out there. Okay, in fact, I went to the seventh edition of the Compendium of Veterinary Products and counted there are more than that right now, but there are 147 DDD vaccine combinations available that you can purchase. Okay, lots of different vaccine companies out there making DDD vaccines. And it's a moving target because they're always changing. They're changing the types of virus in their vaccines, the types of combinations, so forth and so on. So it's a real difficult to keep up with the types of vaccines that we have available. There are two types of DDD vaccines currently in the market that we have available. Just want to talk a little bit about these vaccines. Let me back up here. There are field vaccines, or inactivated. There are modified live, or also known as attenuated vaccines. All right? A little bit about the advantages and disadvantages of these two different types of vaccines. First of all, field vaccines. The advantages, generally, and this is just a general statement, they are safer vaccines, mainly because this is a dead virus. This is a virus that was grown up in culture in a laboratory setting at a pharmaceutical company, and then they kill the virus, so we don't have a live replicating organism that we're potentially giving to the animal. Because of that, and Dr. Ridpath alluded to this earlier, we are not putting a virus that potentially, and I certainly emphasize the point potentially, that could cross the placenta and cause some type of fetal infection and subsequent problems with that fetal infection. In general, field vaccines are more stable. Okay, they are more stable. We can use the vaccine over time as compared to modified live vaccines. Once you mix that desiccated vaccine with the diluent, you have to use that vaccine in a very short period of time. All right? So that's an advantage. The disadvantage of field vaccines, we believe that the protection from field vaccines, at least our current field vaccines that we have on the market, are probably not as good as the modified live vaccines. And this has to do with the duration of the protection provided by those vaccines, and also the breadth of protection. Remember, Dr. Ridpath talked about that we have lots of different strains of DDD virus out there. And it appears that the field vaccines probably don't do as good a job of bridging that breadth of viruses that we have. The immune response that we get to these field vaccines are different than we get to the live virus in the modified live vaccines, okay? And so what we would rather do is try to use a virus or a live virus that more closely mimics the actual immune response that we get with a live virus. So these killed vaccines don't actually do that as well. And in general, shield vaccines are more expensive than live vaccines. I pulled these numbers right off of PBS Online. 10 dose vial triangle versus a 10 dose vial pyramid. You can see that they're about $2 cheaper for the modified live vaccines as compared to the shield. Okay, certainly it's going to vary a little bit, but that's a general statement. Okay, modified live vaccines, on the flip side. Advantage, we generally get better protection with these modified lives against CVD. Okay, that's where we're really focused today, against CVD. The duration seems to be much longer, and the breadth of protection against those multiple strains of BVD viruses appears to be better. Because we're giving them a live virus, the actual immune response that we get more closely mimics the immune response that might occur with a live field strain of the virus. Okay? And certainly that's advantageous. And as we mentioned, the modified live viruses, vaccines tend to be cheaper. The disadvantages, handling, these vaccines are susceptible to inactivation. If you don't handle them correctly, the virus that's in that modified live virus dies, then we're not going to stimulate an immune response that vaccine was intended to do. So if you expose it to extreme heat or extreme cold or UV light, so forth and so on, the vaccine's not going to work like it's supposed to. Okay? And as we mentioned, once you mix that desiccated product with the diluent, in general, you need to use that vaccine in no longer than 4 hours, certainly as soon after you mix it as possible. Okay? There is some concern, at least historically, there's been some concern about the safety of modified live vaccines. Remember, this is a live replicating organism. Okay? So it is a live replicating organism. It infects cells. It has the potential, again, I underline the word potential, to cause some pathology. There's also the potential for transmission of this virus, okay, from these animals. Although if you look at the literature, the chance of transmission of these modified live virus vaccines is remote at best. Okay, so I don't think it should really be a concern. There is the potential for fetal, let's back up here. There's a potential for mutation since we do have a live virus. Okay, we have a virus that's replicating within cells. Under the right circumstances, there is a potential that virus could change and become pathogenic or change to a different type of a BVD virus. Okay, there's also the potential for fetal infection. If we vaccinate an animal that doesn't have a current immune response to BVD, that modified live virus could cross the placenta, cause abortions, cause congenital defects, cause other potential fetal problems. And then you heard earlier that Dr. Ridpath talked about the potential to cause mucosal disease in animals that are persistently infected with BVD. In reality, if it occurs, it's a very rare event. And certain things got to happen. That vaccine that you give them has to be very closely related to that virus that's persistently infecting that calf. And in certain cases, that probably occurs very, very, very rarely. It's something I don't even, that I'm not even concerned about. From a safety standpoint, though, most of these safety concerns, I believe, are really minimal. Okay? Even though I put them up there as a disadvantage, I believe that the safety of a modified live vaccine, if used correctly, is a minimal concern. We now today have, you heard that Dr. Ridpath talked about the fact that we have lots of different strains of BVD, so we actually have kind of a continuum of BVD viruses out there. On one end of the continuum would be our type 2 viruses, and on the other end would be our type 1. And now we have, we kind of divide those into subgenotypes, type 1A and type 1B, and also recently into type 2A and 2B, which I didn't have on here. We now have vaccines that have all of the different genotypes in them. We have vaccines that have type 1 virus in them, both A and B, and we have vaccines that have type 2 virus in them as well. And I just throw up some various products. This is not an inclusive chart. But what I wanted to do is just show you the fact that we have different vaccines out there with different viruses. Okay. So we have a lot of products that have type 1 in them. We have some products and more and more coming out in the market that have type 2 virus in them. In fact, I just was told that Fort Dodge now has a product, their pyramid product, which has both a type 1 and type 2 virus in it. So I just want to show to throw out to you or show you that we have lots of vaccines out there with different types of virus in them, whether it be type 1, type 2. And same thing on the kill side. Again, we have vaccines out there with type 1 virus only in it. We have vaccines out there with type 1 and type 2. So you need to be aware of what types of virus are actually in that vaccine. Okay, so we have lots of vaccines out there, and every time I talk to people in Michigan, maybe it's just Michigan, I don't know, they always tell me that they get a headache from me talking about BVD vaccines. So let's talk a little bit about what role BVD might play in a vaccine program. Well, first of all, and I always tell people there's lots of considerations that we need to think about when we implement a vaccine control or a vaccine program. And here's all the considerations that we talked about when I say this to my students. They run out the door because they think we'll just be able to pick a vaccine out and use it. But there's lots of things that we need to think about. Dr. Woodcock mentioned or told you about the complicated, all the different things that can occur with BVD. She talked about the acute infections, and she talked about the fetal infections. I'm going to first start off by focusing on the ability of vaccine to protect against to protect that fetus against infection. Okay, so as Dr. Woodcock mentioned, preventing fetal infections and the subsequent problems we get with fetal infections is an important important thing we need to do when it comes to controlling BVD. So the first thing we're going to talk about is the ability of our vaccines to protect that developing fetus against fetal infection. There's lots of trials out there that have actually looked at, and these are mostly experimental trials, there's lots of experimental trials out there that have looked at the ability of vaccine to protect against BVD infection, specifically the fetus. Okay? And I've just thrown up some of these up here. And there are more and more fetal challenge studies that are occurring all the time. Pharmaceutical companies are doing more and more of these and getting data out there to actually highlight whether their vaccine or what type of fetal protection we can expect from certain vaccines. But one thing that I want you to notice is that the protection from, at least in the currently published fetal challenge studies, is never 100%. It's never 100%. And depending on challenge virus, the amount of protection is going to change quite a bit. And as an example, these are two studies that I was involved with. These were done back at the end of the 1990s, early 2000. These are studies where we looked at a modified live vaccine, and we vaccinated animals. We then challenged them with either a type 1 virus or a type 2 virus, and look at the differences in fetal protection, depending on the type of virus that was used in the challenge. So just kind of highlight that. What we did was we vaccinated animals with a modified live 1. Can you see that or not? Doesn't look good over here. Type 1 vaccine. We then got them pregnant. That's supposed to be a baby calf in that uterus there. Can I see that? This may not work very good. About 75 days of gestation then, we challenged those pregnant cows in the SNP study with a modified live, with a type 1 BVD field strain, okay? And what we found was that we got 83% protection. So when we vaccinated with a type 1 vaccine, challenged with a type 1 virus, we got 83% protection, okay? Now when we did the flip, when we challenged with a type 2 virus, okay, vaccinated with type 1, challenged with a type 2, then we only got 58% protection. Okay, 58% protection. So the take-home point here is, depending on the strain of the virus that the animals are getting exposed to, will probably dictate how much protection that vaccine will provide that fetus. And just to throw this up here in our controls, these are unvaccinated controls, we were able to get 100% fetal infection, which tells us that our challenge model actually worked. Here's a case report to kind of help drive that point home. This is from Hannah Van Sampen. She was looking at three herds, three beef cow herds that were having high calf mortality. All of these herds were using a modified live type 1 BVD vaccine in their vaccine program. They were having this high calf mortality problem. They went in and did some epidemiological work, some herd screening, And what they found in all these birds is a type 2 virus circulating. Okay? Again, take-home point here is that despite the presence of a vaccine program, they were still getting some BVD-related problems because the virus that they were getting challenged with was different than the vaccine that they're actually using. So my point, vaccination for BVD is not 100%. We need to combine it with biosecurity and PI management. Dr. Larson will talk about that here a little bit later. So from point number two, it makes sense to provide broad protection against the antigenic diversity that we know is present with BVD. Okay? So when I talk to people about BVD vaccines, I tell them that we probably, if we know we're going to get lots of BVD challenges in a herd, okay, maybe we're open herd or a herd that's bringing in cattle a lot, I want to make sure that we try to provide as broad a protection as possible. So that means using a vaccine that has both type 1 and type 2 in it. Okay, you choose your vaccine, but that's my choice. Okay, the other kind of dry cold point that I want to make is timing a BVD vaccine to maximize protection of that fetus, okay? All right? I think we saw a slide earlier. Dr. Utak kind of showed you a similar style slide. This is the timeline of reproductive effects that are caused by BVD. So if we have infection early on, we may have infertility. If we have infection in the first couple months of gestation, we may have early embryonic death. If we have infection in that first trimester area, we get the development of embryo tolerance and the birth of these persistent infected calves. Pretty much clear throughout gestation, we can get abortions. And certainly later in gestation, we get the birth of congenital defects. And if we have infection later in gestation, then we have the birth of these, what may be normal calves, but as Dr. Larson talked about, they may also be abnormal calves that have some problems once they hit the ground. But the point here is that most of the problems occur early on in gestation. Okay, most of the problems occur early on in gestation. So it makes sense that we would like to try to maximize immunity up front prior to these cows getting pregnant. Okay, so if we're going to vaccinate cows, to protect that fetus, it makes sense that we vaccinate them prior to breeding, okay? Instead of in the fall, when they're already 4 or 5 months pregnant, and this is after most of the reproductive problems are going to occur in a cow-calf birth. Okay, so take-home point number three, timing of vaccination should maximize immunity in early vaccination. And to me, that means pre-breeding vaccination, okay? You choose your vaccine, but if we're going to vaccinate for BVD, to maximize protection of that fetus, we ought to be doing it. We ought to be doing it prior to breeding. Okay, so that's it for reproduction. How are we doing, Dale? A little fun. I like that. So how about protection of this of these calves over here? Trying to protect against acute infections. Okay, just a quick summary of some of the information that we have out there on protecting against acute infection. Most experimental studies show good protection against acute disease. So if we get an animal, we can get it well vaccinated, we can probably protect it against some of the acute disease problems that Dr. Ridcock talked to you about earlier. The hemorrhagic syndrome, the respiratory disease, the diarrhea, so forth and so on. Okay, most studies show that protection when vaccine virus and challenge viruses are different is fairly good. So if we vaccinate with a type 1 virus and we challenge with a type 2, we probably get enough cross protection to prevent that animal from getting seriously sick and dying. Okay, then as we go on and do more and more research, we may find that there's some subacute problems, but in general, we're at least going to protect them from getting seriously sick and dying. However, I want to back this up by saying there are no real good large-scale field trials looking at vaccine efficacy. I do want to point out one study that we did at Michigan State just to show you how vaccines might have an advantage in protecting, especially fed cows. This is a study where we asked this question. Can BVD vaccination reduce sickness and death in cattle when constantly being exposed to BVD? So this would be the feedlot situation where we're a pen of calves, and one of those calves in there is persistently infected with BVD. If we vaccinate all those calves that aren't persistently infected, can that vaccine protect all those cats from that one that's a carrier, spreading all that virus and exposing everybody to virus? So what we found was, is that in this blue bar here is calves that received no BVD vaccine. The yellow bar are calves that received the BVD vaccine, and this was given at arrival, okay? And you can see that the animals that we had to treat once, these no, and again, remember, these are all being exposed to BVD constantly because there's a persistent infected animal in there that's shedding tons of virus. What we found is that these non-vaccinated calves, we had to treat about 70% of those calves, whereas the vaccinated calves, we only had to treat about 40%, okay? So, if you put some economics to that, that vaccination at arrival, when we look at the treatment cost, actually saved us about $6 in treatment cost. So there was a $6 advantage to vaccinating those calves at arrival when we knew they were constantly being exposed to BVD in the feedlot operation. Now, having said that, my point, take home point number one with respect to vaccination for acute infection. Protection requirements may not be as stringent as they are for fetal protection. In other words, I think we can vaccinate animals based on our current research. We can vaccinate cattle and prevent acute infections regardless of the type of virus that they're getting exposed to. Okay? Now, I want to go back to the study that I just showed you and show you one other thing that I didn't show you previously. In addition to these vaccinated animals that were exposed to BVD and non-vaccinated animals that were exposed to BVD, there was a third group, and these are calves that were vaccinated, but they were never exposed to BVD. Okay, so they were never exposed to BVD, alright? And as you can see, we only treated about 25% of those, okay? So in these animals, we actually treated less when they were not being exposed to BVD, alright? So take home point number two. Vaccination for BVD is not 100%. Where did you hear that before? Combined with biosecurity and removal of those PIs. You need to get rid of those PIs, okay? Because BVD vaccine is not, or vaccination is not 100%. So to conclude, control and BVD requires biosecurity, seek and destroy those PIs, okay? And then implementation of a vaccine program. And making sure that we emphasize strategic timing of the vaccine and also make sure that we provide broad protection against the diversity that we know exists with this virus. Am I done or do I have one more minute? Alright. So I was coming here on the plane, I usually don't like to roll out vaccine programs, but I thought I at least got to give you. When I talk to producers in Michigan, whether it be dairy producers or beef cattle producers, it doesn't matter. You know, I at least gotta tell you where I start with a vaccine program. Okay, where I start. So I just want to give you what I start with. Okay? So this is my starting place for a BVD vaccination program. This isn't in your notes because I just put this in on the airplane on the way here. Replacement heifers, two doses of a type 1, type 2 BVD completed 30 days prior to breeding. At least one dose should be modified lot, okay? You can do it whenever you want prior to breeding. Make sure you have it done 30 days prior to breeding, okay? That's where I start. That's my starting place, okay? In cows, type 1, type 2, modified live BVD vaccine, 30 days prior to breeding, okay? You choose your vaccine. You choose when you do it. Just make sure it's done 30 days prior to breeding. Okay, that's my starting place. I may then modify it depending on the operation, you know, what type of exposure they may be having, what type of management situation they're in. This is my starting place, and then I go from there, all right? For fed cattle, I always prefer preconditions, so if I can get two doses of a type 1, type 2 BVD vaccine into them, prior to going into a high stress situation, a commingled situation, stock or back end situation, you name it, I'd like to get that done prior to going into that situation, at least one of those two doses needs to be modified live. And then if this isn't occurring, then on arrival, I want to make sure that I get a type 1, type 2 modified live BVD vaccine into them at least once, and then we can debate whether we need to do that more after that. I'm done, and we'll answer questions later. Thank you.
much, Dr. Groom. We appreciate your presentation very much. I'm sure there will be many questions to follow. Just a quick bit of housekeeping. You have the surveys to complete. Hopefully, Carolyn is coming. I really need your input, I'm sorry, for next year's program and future planning. So I really to, I think, draw some conclusions and what can we take home from all the material that's been presented this morning, how can we tie them together, and I guess implement even Dr. Groom's we need to go beyond just vaccination, we need to be designing control programs. That's the topic for Dr. Larkin, so we'll turn the floor back to him.
All right, I think I'm on. Okay, now, the goal, of course, today is to walk out of here much more comfortable and confident about handling BVD and your herds and feedlots, and if you walk away more confused, then we've failed miserably. So I hope that, as all the speakers have come up and have done a wonderful job of really talking about how this virus works and some of the disease attributes, what I'm going to try to talk about is designing a control plan. And I want to, first of all, you know, I can't give enough credit to the number of people that were instrumental in helping walk through and figuring out this particular program. I sat on an ad hoc EVD committee through the Academy of Veterinary Consultants, and we had about a year's worth of meetings with practicing veterinarians that worked primarily with cattle, primarily with feedlot, we had pathologists, virologists, lots of different people, and it took a lot of discussion and a lot of different expertise to come up with what we think is a pretty good starting place for a control program. So what you see here is not my ideas. This is a committee. And all jokes aside, this is a committee that did much, much better than any one person could do by themselves. And so I think that we can design a program that becomes a pretty good boilerplate to put in place in most operations. There may be some fine-tuning that we'd want to do on individual operations, but it becomes pretty able to transfer from one operation to another. And when we talk about control of BVD, I'm going to focus mostly on a PI animal. Why is that? Because I agree with Dr. Rudpath. The acute animals are an important part of the spread of this disease. But when I talk about control programs, I'm stuck with only things I can do something about. And I can't do much about an acute infection. I can do something about a persistently infected animal. I can euthanize them and get them off my farm. So I'm going to focus, when we talk about control, we've really just got a few tools. We've got finding, killing, segregating, and vaccination. And those are the tools we're going to talk about in a control program. So a PI animal, and I think you've got this pretty well figured out, everybody's been repeating it, these animals tend to die. Most of them die either during pregnancy or shortly thereafter. Most of them do. A few of those animals, if they don't die right then, they'll survive as a dink, and you'll find them struggling along. They do shed a tremendous amount of virus. That is why this is kind of a key to the control of this disease, is this is our primary reservoir. It's not the only reservoir, but it is by far the primary reservoir. This little gal is one of my favorites because she just keeps me humble. But I bought her out of a chronic pen. The guy was happy to get rid of her. And we looked in her ear, and she had a Bangs tattoo from 2.5 years ago. So this teaches me a couple of things. I keep telling people these animals die. They do die. They won't survive. And she's my humble girl because she reminds me that they can survive. I don't know. So she's been around for 2.5 years, shedding virus, causing death and destruction everywhere she goes. So I guess she's been quite the gal. But she only stood about this tall. She's a little skinny thing. So she was my perfect example of a terrible-looking calf. But she did not, and I don't know why she didn't. But so most of them die, but God will throw in one of these just to keep you humble. This is more typically what we would expect to see in a PI calf that we do a necropsy on. A lot of times we'll find these, this is supposed to be nice and smooth, esophagus, but it's got all these erosions, quite painful. the brain lesions that we see in kids that get infected. This is back to that same calf. We look at the esophagus. You get erosions in the mouth. That's a pretty typical finding on our textbook cases of BVD. As Julia pointed out, they're not all textbook cases, of course, but this is what we look for. This is the other one that keeps you humble. I showed you these nice, nasty-looking kids, the dinks, the ones that look terrible. But doggone it, some of these kids will appear normal. They'll make it to weaning or beyond looking fine. That's a soccer calf that you could not have picked out a lot. There's no way you could have. He's fat and growing, not having been pulled for the sick pen, hadn't gone out. I mean, he was doing great. And if we hadn't been looking for him for a while, we wouldn't have been looking for this guy. So they can appear normal. Here's another girl in that group. So most of them die. The ones that don't die, most of them look bad. But there's enough good-looking ones in there to keep you humble and to be a problem. That's why we test more than just the ugly ones. Okay? So when we look at a diagnostic workup, and this is, what I'm going to talk about first is, I suspect BVD in this herd. Maybe I've done some necropsies on some calves and I've gotten BVD back on them. I've done some other testing, and I know that BVD virus is circulating in this herd. I found a bunch of acute infections or something. So I've got a good reason to go in and start looking for persistently infected animals, these big reservoirs. The development of the immunohistochemistry test, the UNOX test, I think most of you are familiar with, has been a great, great help in this fight. This is just a little plastic cassette that those go into. You take an UNOX sample, put it under the microscope after the staining that is done with this test, you end up with staining along the skin samples of the ear. Basically, everywhere you see a little brown dot is a virus particle, and that amazes me. When we say these TI animals are just loaded with virus, this is the skin of the ear, for crying out loud, and it's just loaded with virus. That's a lot of virus. Think what's in his input, boom, blown out his nose, what's in his spleen and other places. Am I not on? Oh, okay. This is just a negative. No staining. So these animals have a tremendous amount of virus, and this is a great test. And as Dr. Ridcraft pointed out, this test does not pick up the acute or the transiently infected animal. In a control program, that's actually good, because I don't want to be confused with the transiently infected animals. I want to find the PIs, euthanize them, and get them out of there as quickly as possible. I don't want to go in and euthanize all the acute animals. That's too many. Okay? And they're not a persistent source of this virus. They're transient. They're a source of the virus for 2 weeks, and then they're not anymore. Okay, so from a control standpoint, I want to find these animals and get them out of there as quickly as possible. Now, one of the ways that, and I'm going to talk about this, and I started in the first talk I did, differentiating is my herd at high risk or low risk for this disease. And I think that's where we have to start. I need to get that under my belt to know how aggressive I should be in a diagnostic plan. So I like to do this always BVD screening on the highest risk group of cattle out there. In my opinion, the highest risk group of cattle for having BVD are the dead ones. They're probably going to be my highest prevalence of finding the virus. So I like to do lots of necropsies. You know, if I could say one concept, it's necropsies are great. And one of the great things about them is you're not only monitoring for BVD. If I'm routinely necropsing the dead calves, feeder calves, weaning calves, if I'm routinely necropsing them, I'm monitoring them for a lot more diseases than just BVD. So it's a good overall biosecurity step to monitor what's going on in the herd. But from a BVD standpoint, if I am necropsing a lot of the dead calves and I'm not finding BVD, my assumption is it's not there from a, not a pure technical standpoint, but from a, I'm not going to worry about it. If I'm not finding it in the dead calves, I'm not going to worry about it. Okay? Now, if I don't do very many necropsies and I don't find it in the dead calves, that doesn't mean much. But if I'm doing a lot of necropsies and I never find it, I'm not going to worry about it. Okay, so if I don't find any evidence of BVD being present, I'm still going to initiate my biosecurity measures in. And that's mostly exactly what Dr. Grooms was talking about. I'm going to have a vaccination program. I'm going to do some control of fence lines, and that starts to sound a little academic. So, with the hand you have dealt, manage your fence lines the best you can. I don't like to put pregnant cattle next to stocker cattle. I think that do everything you can to avoid that matchup. If you've got pregnant cattle running against your neighbor's pregnant cattle, see if you can encourage them to come to a good BVD meeting and get them on a good control program too, so they're at low risk. So manage your fence line contact. Again, real world, but manage what you're dealt with. Now, and also, all replacements I'm going to check. Anything I purchase and buy onto the farm, I'm going to make sure they're not a PI animal. I'm not going to buy this problem. Okay, so if I have no evidence that BVD is on my place, I'm going to vaccinate, I'm going to watch my fence lines, and I'm going to test everything that comes in. And that's all I'm going to do. Now, if I have evidence that BVD is present, I've done some necropsies. I found some PI animals. I found a lot of transiently infected animals. I have evidence that virus is circulating on my farm. Then I'm going to do something different. I'm going to do these things also. I'm going to do my baseline. I'm going to do what every herd. But I'm also going to find those PI animals and get them out of there. So this is when I jump in and I do a real aggressive effort to find the PIs and get them out of the herd. And that's going to involve testing all the calves, test some of the dams, and test my replacement. I'm going to go into that a little bit more here. So if I have a high-risk herd, so I just put it in that category of this herd, I think I've got a darn good chance of finding some PI calves in there. This is what I'm going to do, or what I'm going to suggest that you do. I'm going to test all the calves. I'm going to test all the cows that don't have a calf that day. I'm going to say this again in a little bit, but I'm going to say it now. I want to do this before the breeding season starts. Remember, the only time I can cause a PI is during the first half of pregnancy. So I want to do all my testing before the bull goes out there. So on test day, I've got a bunch of little suckling calves. I'm going to test every single one of them. Any cow that doesn't bring me a calf, I'm going to test her. She's open. The calf died already. Whatever reason, she doesn't bring me a calf, I'm going to test her. And I'm going to test my bulls. I don't expect to find bulls that are positive, but I've been schooled enough times that I'm humble enough to say, let's still test them. I don't expect to find a positive bull, but let's not prove me wrong. So I'm going to, anything that's test negative, just stay in the herd. Test positive, if it's an adult, cow bull, they immediately go to slaughter. There is no human health concerns with BVD. It's an animal health concern. But those animals need to get off of your farm today as quickly as possible. Now, if it's test positive calf, first thing I'm going to do is take him and his mama and segregate them. Because I got the test results today, I'm going to go out there and get them away from the rest of them. I'm going to probably immediately euthanize that calf. And the reason is, from a diagnostic test standpoint, no test is 100%. But this calf already had strike one. I suspected BVD in this herd. Strike one, right? I get a positive test back, strike two, I'm probably going to euthanize him. I'm going to tell you a different story here in a little bit about a positive test. But on this herd where I suspect BVD, if I find the test positive, I'm going to assume it's a true positive, and I'm going to euthanize that calf. Now, I'm going to test his dam also. Because most of these dams are negative. Remember, the only time an animal can become a PI is when they were in the womb. You can't become a PI later. That's why this test is nice. If I test them at day one, they're negative, they will never become a positive. So the only time they can become a PI animal is during pregnancy. So most of these dams that had a PI calf, they themselves are fine. They were just exposed to the virus during that key window of their pregnancy, and the calf got infected, and the calf becomes a PI. But the dam is fine. So I want to test her. Most likely, she'll test negative, and she goes back in the herd. I don't have to call her. And I'm answering some of the phone calls I get as we go along here. I get a question all the time. I tested the calf, but I sell the mother. If the mother is negative, keep her. But from a natural exposure standpoint, she ought to be the most protected cow on your herd. She was suckling in a little virus factory. She ought to be well protected. Okay, so she can stay. But if she happens to be negative, positive, then she needs to immediately go to slaughter. And according to Whittem's trial that I talked about earlier, this was about 7% of the cases, and this was 93% of the cases. So almost always, she can stay. Once in a while, she can't. And I've got to do this before the breeding season starts. Otherwise, if I do it halfway through the breeding season, the one thing this test does not tell me, it doesn't tell me the status of the fetus. And so if we've got a bunch of cows out there that are 60 days pregnant, I've done all this money, I've spent all this money to test everything that's alive on my place, and I still have no idea if there's 40 PI calves inside mamas. Okay, so I want to do it before there's any calves inside mama. So the timing is important for this effort. This is an expense. This is, I'm encouraging you as your veterinarian to go out and spend a ton of money. Let's do it right. And the timing is important. Most often, we as the veterinarians, we'll get weaned of a PI problem, say at weaning or midway through gestation, you're trying to have an abortion, and the producer, let's do something today. My answer is usually, we're going to do this next spring. And so you have to understand why we're saying that. To go in and do a big testing effort right now would spend a lot of your money, and we'd have to do it again next spring anyway, because I don't know what's inside the cows. Okay, so the timing is important. So if BDD is suspected in a herd, I'm going to do it prior to the breeding season, and I like the skin biopsy test because I can do it at very young age animals. Some of the other tests are not very good for baby calves, and I want to test baby calves, so it's a very good test with that. I want to do all calves, any cow that didn't bring me a calf, and any replacement animals that are on the place that are getting ready to enter that breeding season. I'm going to euthanize all positive. In subsequent years, I'm going to always do my replacements, even my raised ones. That may be overkill, but I don't think so. I'm going to do all my replacements, because that's a pretty small number on a herd basis, and I think it's a reasonable thing to do. And I like to, just for my monitoring, always be looking at high-risk populations. So dead animals, sick animals, are ones to kind of keep your finger on the pulse of what's going on with BDD in those herds. And then I'm going to use the vaccination program. And like everybody else has said, and Dr. Green's really pointed out, vaccination program is an important part of my biosecurity, but it's not it. That's not my program. And that's one of the things that I started today saying, why are we talking so much about this disease again? Just a few years ago, what was my biosecurity program for BDD? The vaccine program. And that's all it was. We've done some new tests that give us some great tools that we didn't have a few years ago. So we've got a much, much better, more complicated, whatever you want to call it, but a much better way to control this disease than we did just a few years ago. So I'm still going to use my vaccines, but I can do a lot more than just vaccinate now to control this disease. Now, where you live, probably everybody can before we start the next breeding season. Where I live, occasionally, when the bull goes out, there's still pregnant cows. Okay? That, you may not know what I'm talking about, but that occasionally happens where I live. And so, what do you do with the ones that are still pregnant? My answer is, you have to remove them. And this is, again, another place where people balk. Okay, I calve over a 3 or 4 or 5 month period, 12-month period. What do I do with the ones that are pregnant when you want to test them? They have to be removed physically and put in another place. Move them to the Johnson place, the North place, something like that. If you're not willing to do that, then don't spend the money to test. Okay? So they have to be physically removed because that fetus is an unknown. Even if I eunuched every one of those cows, that doesn't do me much good. Because remember, I could have a PI fetus in that cow, and most of the time the mom's going to be fine. She's going to test negative. So I have to remove those animals and physically put them in a new location when the bull goes in with the group that I've already tested. If you're not willing to do that, I would encourage you not to test. Okay? So do it all or don't do it. Do it all or don't do it at all. Don't do it halfway. Now, the other frustrating thing we get into is sometimes by doing my strategy, I'll test a bunch of animals, and I won't find any PIs. Does that mean there's no PIs there? Well, this is when I start having to kind of dance around and shop a little bit. Maybe not. Maybe it was a totally unrelated disease process that was causing the problems you saw. The other option is it could have been BDD, and there's the 3 or 4 BDD calves that really started this virus circulating in the herd are dead now. And you didn't get to test them. Remember, I'm testing this after a bunch of them are already born, and probably a bunch of them are already dead. And so it's possible to do all this effort and not have any PIs in there. Does that mean I was wrong in my assessment that this was a high-risk herd? Maybe. Or maybe not. Maybe I just didn't find them. But that's still okay, because I did it before the start of the breeding season. I'm going into the next breeding season knowing that there's not any of those PI animals out there. That typhoid Mary, Trojan horse, whatever. And so I still do you a great service, because we're going to go into this breeding season with no PI animals in there. Whether I was right or not, we know that this year there's no PIs in contact with this herd as we start in the breeding season. And again, I'm going to utilize my vaccination protocol. And given the hand you've dealt, deal with your fence lines the best you can. Now, another aspect of what I'm going to call biosecurity is, what do I do? So if I was in veterinary practice still, and I'd have some clients that I really suspected BVD problems in, so I would institute the program I just talked about. But the vast majority of my clients, I have no indication that there's PIs or a BVD problem in their herd. And the pregnancy percentage is great. They're not having a lot of suckling calf losses. They're doing fine at weaning. So what do I do then? Do I put them under the same sort of an aggressive program? Probably not. But let's talk about those herds a little bit. So if I've got most of my clients, I don't suspect BVD is a big problem in that herd. Okay? So what do I do there? Strategy one, the one that I'll probably use most frequently with most of my clients, is a low-cost but low-sensitive strategy. And I'll tell you what I mean by that. In that, what I'm just going to describe has a slow response to PI introduction. I'm going to measure production. Now, in order for production to take a hit so that I would start becoming suspicious of BVD, production has to take a hit. So it's slow. It's a year late. Okay? But it's probably appropriate for most of the herds I deal with. I'm going to monitor my pregnancy proportions. I'm going to monitor how quickly they get pregnant. Not only my overall pregnancy rate, but how many of them get pregnant quick and early like I expected to. And I'm going to monitor my high-risk populations, my sick and dead animals. I'm going to try to recap as many of those as I can. And if I don't find BVD in my sick and dead animal, and if my cows are getting pregnant and they're doing great, that's probably my monitoring. That's my way to keep my finger on the pulse of this herd. That's how I'm going to monitor them for BVD, and I'm not going to spend any more. That's how much I'm going to spend. That's what I'm going to do. The other place I like to do it besides the dead ones, again, are just the weird cases. And I've just run into a few, enough of these to make me want to blame BVD all the time. It doesn't work out that way. But a certain percentage of these weird cases, scours when they shouldn't be scouring. Foot rot that's just driving me crazy because they shouldn't be having it. Pink eye, same thing, kind of thing. I might, in some of those instances, go in and do some screening of those affected animals. Now, in these cases, a positive test needs to be confirmed. So, again, this becomes how it's a little bit dangerous sometimes to talk to your neighbor if you both have the same veterinarian, because I might give one guy one advice, and like, I suspected BVD on one farm, on the Jones farm, and I get a positive trap, I say shooting, getting out of there as quick as possible. Another farm, I have no indication that BVD is in there, and they get a positive, and I say, ooh, better test him again. And that's what I would do when I'm working with clients. Different advice for different people, even though the test is a pretty darn good test. There are a few false positives in any test, and I'm going to be a little more cautious if there's no evidence of PI being in there, and I find one test, I'm going to confirm it. Now, this is a strategy Dr. Green should probably talk about a lot about more than I can, using serology. There's been at least one paper published looking at using what we call sentinel animals, unvaccinated animals, because it's a lot easier to interpret the titers in unvaccinated animals than in vaccinated animals. A good sentinel population, a lot of times, is calves right before weaning. If you didn't handle them at a younger age, they're still unvaccinated. And it's been shown that in dairy calves, at least, you could use serology of these sentinel animals to kind of monitor the BVD status. I have a very difficult time interpreting BVD titers. I cannot interpret BVD titers. So if you hand me And I give this speech, and I'll say, I can't interpret, and then I'll go to the back room, and I'll say, somebody will bring their titles to me and show them, what do you think of Jesus? You don't hear me. I can't interpret them. Somebody else maybe can, but I can't. So I don't have any way to use them. Poor PCR, another new test, relatively new, that is a great tool, and it's because it can be used with pooled samples. You can pool large groups of blood samples, milk samples, those kinds of things. It is, it can be used in these herds where I don't expect problems, but I want to screen a lot of animals relatively inexpensively. By putting 20 to 30 blood samples together, and you don't have to do that. I don't even have to do it as your practitioner. The lab will do that. So I send them and I say, pool them in pools of 30. They'll take 30 samples, pool them together, and if it's negative, in one shot I got 30 negative animals. Okay? So that's why it's convenient. Now, the negative of this is it doesn't differentiate between my transiently infected and persistently infected animal. This test is extremely sensitive. So any little bit of virus will pick it up. So then if I get a positive back on my pool of 30 of them together and I get a positive back, one of those or two of those or whatever could be a persistently infected animal, or one of them could be a transiently infected animal. So then, in that case, I need to either go back and sometimes the lab can re-split and re-pool and get me down to the five that it suspects, or I can go in and I can do an ear notch test or something like that at that point. So the advantage of doing pools is large groups of negative pools, pretty inexpensive way to say, they're negative, move on. Positive pools, I got to go back and I got to mess with them. So negatives are great. Positives are, I tell you, by the way, Joe, you need to pull that calf, that calf, you know. So you see the pluses and minuses. Large groups of negatives are great. A large group of positives is inconvenient. So, but it can be used. This is a good tool and it's being used by some places. So that is strategy four. And remember, this is not herds where I suspect a problem. This is a herd where I don't suspect a problem. But I still may have a few clients that I encourage them to do ear notching on every calf every year. Now, why in the world would I do that? If they can get a marketing advantage for doing that, basically. And that might be my purebred herds, herds that are marketing a lot of replacement stock. Those kinds of herds may benefit from an extremely high level of screening and biosecurity. So if they can reap an economic reward for that level of screening, help them, you know, do it. Do it. Again, the timing is, I'm always going to do it before the breeding season. Because what if, you know, I don't expect to find a positive, but what if I do, and the bull's been out for a month and a half? Well, I just set up the potential for huge problems next year. So do it before the breeding season, even if I don't expect much problem. And this is one where I always confirm the positive. And again, I've got this herd that I've just been fighting DDD for 2 years, so I get them to do a whole herd screening. They find one positive, I say, you immediately go euthanize that animal today. This other guy, he's got purebred cattle, you know, he's really proud of him, those kind of things. I don't expect DVD in there at all, and I get a positive. Before he runs off and shoots the next Denver champion, I want him to confirm that test. So I'm going to give different advice to different people based on the history of the herd and what's going on. So the tests are pretty darn good. I don't expect a lot of positives, false positives or false negatives, but I consider the source when I look at it. Now, other biosecurity concerns. So rather than just testing my cow pastures, some of the other things I look at, open females, they're pretty easy. I'm going to ear notch them before I let them on my place. I don't want to buy a PI animal. Are animals likely to be a PI that is 3 or 4 years old? No. Very darn unlikely. A heifer might happen. Wouldn't be surprised. But I'm still going to test anything that I buy and bring on my farm. I'm going to quarantine them. I want to make sure that if they are acutely infected or transiently infected with BDD virus, I want them to go through that and stop shedding before I bring them in contact with my cows. So I think 30 days is plenty. We typically think of them shedding for 2 weeks or so. So I think there's a 30-day quarantine period. You're setting yourself for some good buffers on there. Now, bred females. I love Dr. Woodpack. Once I bought a bred heifer, I've heard this history too. This is a great way to bring BDD into a herd is buying pregnant heifers. And sometimes the heifers have been ear notched when I buy them. But what do we know about the fetus inside it? Nothing. We know a mother's not a PI, but that fetus could be. Okay? And so when I purchase bred females, I want to quarantine them until that calf is born. I don't want that calf being born PI and putting right in contact with my herd that is pregnant or going to be pregnant soon. I don't want to start that virus circulating. So I want to quarantine them until that calf is born. And is that inconvenient? In a lot of farms, yes. But I still want you to do it. If you're buying animals in, wait till it's bred out before you put them in with the rest of the herd. And test that calf as soon as he hits the ground. So only introduce the paradigm once the calf is proven to be a non-PI. I want to emphasize again, I want to go back just a little bit. One of the reasons that I do just testing the calves is I get 2-for-1. If the calf is negative, his mother is negative. Because every PI mother will always have a PI calf. Just think that. She's got virus circulating around in her blood like crazy. It's going to cross the placenta, it's going to infect that calf, and if it survives, it'll be born a PI. Okay? So, I always, by testing just the calves and not all the cows, I get 2-for-1. Every negative calf has a negative mother. Not every positive calf has a positive mother, but every negative calf has a negative mother. I've learned a lot about how well I speak or don't speak, or how poorly I speak, because I'll give this talk, and then shortly thereafter, a couple weeks later, a veterinarian will call and say, heard you talk, think I got a PI problem, you're not called the cows, what do I do with the samples?
Right.
Obviously, I didn't speak very well. Don't you not call the cows. You're not called the parents. And a few of the cows, the ones that I told you about, they don't bring me a calf that day. Then I'll internotch them. But I'm internotching parents, not cows, because I get 2-for-1. So once that calf is proven a non-PI, his mother is as well. That was the point for that little diversion there. If the calf's negative, his mother's negative, they can both enter the herd. Bull. This is kind of one I want to expect, and I got it, if you live long enough, you see a lot of interesting things. I don't expect bulls to be positive PIs, animals, but they can be. And again, some of the virulence factors we talked about, some of the things we don't know. Why did that one heifer I pulled out of Conniston live to be 2.5 years old? I don't know. She's not supposed to. Supposed to be dead by then. So occasionally you'll get surprised. BVD virus can be shed in the semen, so I don't want to buy a PI bull. So after I paid the purchase price of the bull, getting the ear notch is pretty small potatoes to make sure I don't bring a PI bull onto the place. And the virus can be transmitted from the bull to cows. Now he's not likely to cause PI calves in the cows that he breeds. They just probably won't settle very fast. Now, if there's other cows that are around him that are pregnant already, because he's blowing the virus out of his nose and everything else, he can cause them to have PI calves. His offspring are not likely to be PIs. The other cows in the herd bred by another bull might be, that he blows snot on. So, AI sires, basically if you're working with a reputable AI collection group, they have techniques in place to make sure that that's not a problem. You're not going to buy BVD infected semen if you work with most of our suppliers. Again, I'm going to isolate purchase bulls for 30 days, not only for BVD purposes, but for others. But for this BVD talk, that way I know that if they were transient infected, they'll be over that before I bring them in contact with the cowherd. Fomites, inanimate objects, things like that. We know that virus can survive in fecal material for a while. Again, environmental contamination is not a huge concern with this disease, but it's part of it. It plays a role. Okay? And so, if we had been able to, in experiments, pass the virus from PI animals to susceptible animals with things like palpation sleeves, nose tongs, injection needles, those kinds of things. Again, it's not likely to work with a transient and infected animal to pass it from one animal to another. But if you were to work with a PI animal and then turn around and work with some susceptible animals, it's possible to pass it. Human activities can pass the virus. Embryo transfer, there have been a couple of wrecks in embryo transfer that have been investigated back and found to be BVD related. So if you're doing embryo transfer, again, the groups, the societies that deal with that have written standards to make that risk relatively low, but it's not non-existent. You really need to watch that. So, here's another thing. You talk about embryo transfer. You're dealing with a technique that's expensive, and you're putting expensive embryos in there, and so you buy the cheapest cow you can buy to put it into. At least test that cheapest cow. Make sure you're not putting a nice embryo into a persistently infected heifer, something like that. So make sure your recipients are not PIs. I think Dr. Ridcock was saying the bovine fetal fluids that we use in a lot of the techniques with embryo transfer, again, we don't want those to be BVD contaminated fluids. We don't want them taken from a BVD animal. Wildlife, BVD has been isolated from a number of species of wildlife. You have to correct me. I have not seen the papers where the PI state has been shown to be in deer and elk. I may be behind on my knowledge. But even in areas where we see wildlife as a vector, I think that the cattle are the primary reservoir. And if we got rid of the cattle reservoir, I would expect the wildlife reservoir to decrease. There's a lot we don't know about wildlife, so don't carve that into any kind of a hard object coming out of my mouth. But I think that the wildlife reservoir is primarily a reflection of the cattle reservoir. And if we attack the cattle reservoir, we'll bring the wildlife reservoir down too. There's still more to be learned in that area. Now, I'm going to go pretty quickly through this, and I just want to say that I'm just going to echo what Dr. Groom said. Everything we've said about biosecurity so far are some new things that have been allowed, that we are allowed to do now because of some new tests that have been given us in the last few years. And I think if you're not using them in a BVD control program, you need to be. Now, the other tool we have is vaccination. Keep using it. So that's my summary of what Dr. Groom said. So I want to reiterate that there is some cross protection, probably important to get a broader exposure to the vaccine viruses when we're talking about fetal protection on the cow side than respiratory disease or acute disease control. So my recommended program is very similar to Dr. Green's. Focus on the replacement animals, 2 to 3 doses of modified livestock breeding, basically adults annually. Vaccinating calves may not give us titers, but probably provides us some protection. If I'd had time, I would have taken these out, Dr. Grimms, because you already covered this. So my control program is this. Finding your new PI animals. That relatively complicated screening program I gave you, where I'm going to test all calves, all dams that don't bring a calf, and all the replacement animals on my farm. I'm going to do that. If I suspect BVD, I'm going to find them and I'm going to get rid of them. I'm going to segregate and isolate. I'm going to manage, given the hand I'm dealt, I'm going to manage my fence line the best I can. Keep my animals away from the herd. And I'm going to function all replacements. And I'm going to use my vaccination to decrease the negative effect if virus does get into the herd. This is a common virus. And if all the biosecurity was perfect, I wouldn't have to vaccinate. I'm assuming it's not going to be perfect. So I want vaccination in place to minimize the negative effects when virus does come in contact with the herd. Now, I've been talking mostly about calf operations. What about stock and food lot operations? What do we do then? Well, this is a question I've struggled with over the last couple of years. Because food lot and stock operations, particularly I work with a stock operation that's going through a wreck. Just dead calves all over the pasture. We go through, we find a bunch of PIs. This is terrible. This is a huge economic loss. Doc, what can we do? Should we start screening everything? We got this new test. Should I screen everything? Very valid question. Should a stocker operation screen every calf that comes onto the place? Good question. My answer is probably, from an economic standpoint, no. Those wrecks occur infrequently enough. As painful as they are, they incur infrequently enough to justify pain testing all the times when they're not occurring. Okay? The other thing is because this is a completely unknown risk. In other words, Dr. Craig coming in from all over, my positives, I'm almost always going to encourage you to retest them, which is inconvenient and another cost. Because I'm worried about euthanizing perfectly healthy animals because there's a false positive. Now, we may be able to, I'm looking down the future, if we describe this disease better, maybe with our national ID program and those kind of things, if we were able to identify higher risk groups of feeder cattle they might just screen those out.
Today, we don't have that information. There's no indication of any particular higher risk group of cattle. And the other problem with testing them at arrival at my stocker facility is if I find a positive, a lot of the economic loss has already occurred. So when I deal with a stocker operator that's going through a wreck and he's pulling his hair out and says, I don't want to deal with this again, should I start screening everything? My answer tends to be no. Now, I want to go on a little bit further though. Should I purchase animals that are certified PI-free? Heck yeah, if you can get it. I mean, you've just decreased the big risk. You've decreased the risk of one of those wrecks that occurs once in a while. So it has great value to you if the person, the ranchers you're dealing with, because of their biosecurity, either they're testing everything or because of their program in place, they're very low risk. You bet. That decreases your risk. That has some value. And you can do the math pretty quickly to figure out what that is. I put in kind of my high level here. It may be worth $10 a head. It may be worth less than that. That's probably the high end. But it's worth something to you to buy those animals that are certified free. What about just low risk? Dealing with clients, repeat clients that are relatively low risk. Again, you bet. That's what we're looking for. So with stock and food lot operations, and I'm hoping that maybe some of you have some experience, talking to veterinarians that have worked with a lot of different veterinarians that work with a lot of different stock and food lot operations, they're not using the test so much as an economic reward directly back to the stocker operation. They're using it as a communication tool. If it's retained ownership cattle from a cap standpoint, I might screen, and again, what I'm going to do is my high-risk populations. And in a feedlot, that's my deads and chronics. So I might earmark deads and chronics from clients that are cow-calf guys that are returning ownership to me for one reason, to offer them a service back. You know, to build some loyalty to them, show that I'm really trying to help them. So there's a communication reason to do that. The other reason I might do that is because if I'm the veterinarian working with this and we're having a wreck, I want to tell you why we're having a wreck. Don't blame me. It's that DVD. I make a joke, but that's realistic too. I want to be testing my clients and my deads to get back to the person that sent them to me so that we can discuss more fully the health wreck that they may be having. And if I'm not finding it, well, then I cross that edge. I don't get to blame DVD for this one. if I'm checking and don't find it. So it becomes a communication test, communication tool that is more driven by client loyalty, doing a service for your clients, building a better communication of what's going on health-wise with groups of cattle than it is, oh, I spend $8, I get how many bucks back. So my general opinion as far as for stock and food lot operations is based on the math that I've done so far, I can't justify screening them at arrival. If you can buy them as low risk, I think that's a value. If you can screen your high-risk populations, your deads and chronics, that may have some real communication benefits to you. So that's how I like to look at it for those groups. And this is what we're already doing. Buying groups of cattle at low risk, you build it into your cost equation. You just throw it in there, and it's part of the health risk, and you should purchase accordingly. Okay. Everybody knows my dad. That's him right there. I'll wind it up. Are we ready for some questions? Is that what you want to do here? Okay. Let's Dr. Grimes is here, Dr. Ridpath. We'll open it up for some more questions that you may have. Yeah, I'll take this thing off so we can pass it around.
Questions? This book drafted by Dr. Groom on the vaccination. Why does both of you both have a question mark on
It's only in your notes, and that's because when I did the notes a month ago,
I didn't know the virus name, and if you actually look up on the slide, I now have the virus up in there. So the only reason is those because at the time I made the slide, I didn't have the actual virus that was in there, the name of the virus. Just the fact that this had to be done a month ago. And I want to point out that list of vaccines, that was not an all-inclusive list, okay? And there are lots of other vaccines out there, good vaccines. As I mentioned, just was made aware that Fort Dodge had a type 1 infection modified by the DVD vaccine. So the only reason I put that in there is to show you the diversity of the viruses that are present in our vaccines out there. That's the only reason. It wasn't saying this is a better vaccine than another one.
Okay, question right here.
Can you repeat the question in the mic there? Might be the easiest.
Son, my question was, BVD helps break down immunity in calves. Do we know whether or not it's a precursor for diseases like mycoplasma? Science that might back that up for that kind of
right now, the science, anecdotally, we hear a lot about mycoplasma and BVD. So far as I know, the science doesn't go any farther than BVD breaking down immunity. There may be a direct interaction between BVD and mycoplasma. You guys have insight on that?
There was actually a paper out of Canada that showed a relationship that a high percentage, so less than 100% of mycoplasma cases were persistently infected animals, first of all. And so there is a link there. It's not 100%, but there is a link.
That's exactly right. That study was done. And in my mind, it makes sense. I mean, we know this is an immunosuppressive virus, and in reality, it's probably associated with other things, too, besides mycoplasma. It could be Haemophilus somnus or just straight-out Mannheimia or Pastoral hemolytica problems. So, but I would guess that there is an association simply because it suppresses the immune system and allows that bacteria to get in the lungs and cause problems. Wouldn't surprise me at all.
Dr. Berliner?
Dr. Goodbath, we're constantly semen testing all the yearling bulls. Test all our older bulls. Is it possible then that we could pool these semen samples as part of a surveillance for a yearling bull operation?
Thank you for asking that question, because that would be a good strategy for, and fits very much in with your low risk. Pooling them would be much cheaper than ear notching everybody. And the other thing that that Dan Givens and Kenny Brock are doing out at Auburn, it's also been done by Joe Brownlee in the UK, is that we told you about acute infections and persistent infections. There seems to be something strange that goes on with prepubescent bulls, and that if you get an acute infection as a neonate, after they've been born, this we're not talking about a fetal infection, but after they've been born, if you get an acute infection, they may establish a persistent infection that gives rise to BVD being spread in the serum, in the semen. The other thing that can happen with some adult bulls is that an acute infection can give rise to prolonged shedding in the semen. And so these animals eventually will pull it out of the semen, but will shed it long after they have it, long after you can get it out of buffy coat or out of serum. So ear notching isn't going to pick up these two occurrences.
With regard to congenital defects, what are you seeing? What are you seeing in that regard?
Should let the veterinarians answer this. You see a lot of things. Classically, it's the sickle hock and the domed head, the kind of looks like a deer face animal, short in stature, barrel shaped body structure. They seem to have the rumen, the organs, the soft organs keep growing, but it's like the bone growth can't keep up with it. So on these little shorty, you showed a classic picture of that your little 2.5-year-old girl. She probably felt more like a barrel anything else born normally that year. They'll have a tendency to have break bones more easily. In one operation I was working with, that was the first thing they noticed, is they had three calves that had broken legs after birth. So there's a lot of different things going on. Poor coat quality. This is something you also see with hairy shaker and border disease. So a lot of different things. Just with poor deer animals, they look kind of scruffy, but once again, we have to remember we may not be able to see all these. And some of the congenital defects aren't visible. And they're only going to become visible when you challenge the immune system and the immune system doesn't work correctly, or you put them in under some kind of stress and they just can't respond to stress well. So just from a structural standpoint, they're going to look completely normal. The congenital defects that are silent.
If I can add to that real quick, Monty, the classical congenital defect of calves infected with BVD is a cerebellar hyperplasia. The cerebellum is a part of the brain that actually controls your ability to be coordinated, okay? So the virus affects that part of the brain, doesn't develop it like it should, and so when these calves are born, they may not be able to stand, or if they can, they're very uncoordinated. They wobble, they have a wide-based stance, they stumble around. That's kind of the classical congenital defect that you might see, and we've seen it fairly often.
There's a fairly long list of those congenital defects, too, and they're just talking about the most prevalent ones. It goes down there. There are hair defects, eye defects. The list is fairly long.
A couple questions. One is long-term, keeping a herd free. So when you're doing testing, maybe Bob, you could answer this. Is there any data out there that says, well, we've kept a herd free for 1 year, 2 years, 3 years, 4 years? You know, what are the implications? How long has it been done? Have you seen anything? And then my other question is another one we've bantered about for a while is the risk of mutations and all the vaccines with BVDs with type 1, type 2 mutation recombination. What's the scope of the risk there?
I'll take part of that and I'll pass off part of it. On a control program, if a farm has had a pretty stringent BVD control program in for a number of years, make sure I'm going to answer this right, but as far as what you're asking, if the question is how long do they need to keep doing it, it depends a lot on the location of that animal, how many, what kind of fence line contact and those kind of things. Theoretically, if I had no fence line contact, if I did a whole herd screening 1 year, and I wouldn't screen anything that I purchased after that, that would all be all I need to do. I have very few clients that have no other risk factors, such as no fence line contact. And so, in those herds, what I tend to want to do is continue with my screening of replacement animals that I bring into a herd. There is still the present risk of exposure from fence line, possibly wildlife, someplace else, to bring it in and cause then a real blip in my exposure. That is why I think that vaccination is a critical part of the overall biosecurity. I'm going to do all I can from a biosecurity standpoint to minimize the risk that those animals, that my herd's going to come in contact with a PI animal. That being said, it's very difficult to make sure they never come into contact with an acutely infected animal or a wildlife vector. So then I'm going to rely on my vaccinations to minimize the negative effect of that. So I think I can establish a protocol for a herd for a long period of time where their risk of coming into contact with a PI animal is pretty low. Now, again, that depends a lot on fence line contact. But I find it very difficult to prevent them from coming into contact with transiently infected or acutely infected animals. As far as the recombination of virus and mutation, I'm going to pass that to Julia.
I just like to continue a little bit. Everybody thinks they have a closed herd, but sometimes they don't factor. Okay.
I don't know.
Sometimes they don't factor to the point that animals going in and out in shared equipment. So if you send animals to the show ring, you have to quarantine them when you bring them back because you don't even know their status for acute infections. And the reason I bring this up is the State County Fair in the county I live in had a project for 4-H students called Suckling Calf, Bucket Calf. So they just think it was not how good the calves looked, but whether the 4-H child could come up with a good feeding plan and whether that animal gained weight and if they it was more about husbandry. Well, why would you have a bucket calf? Well, these guys would just go to the sale barn and buy a calf. Why are you selling a bucket calf? Well, we went in and tested our 15 bucket calf at our county fair one year. Two of them were black. And these all animals were housed in the same barn. So everybody went home from the fair with a nice exposure to BVD. So you worry about fence line, but you also worry about sharing a trailer with somebody else who doesn't have a BVD program or in the show ring or at the 4-H fair or things like that. So now, as far as recombination, I have to talk about theoretical risk and real risk. All the recombinations we've seen so far have not occurred in tissue culture. They've occurred in persistently infected animals, and that's because of opportunity. There's a lot of viral replication going on throughout the lifetime of that persistently infected animal. So the opportunity for recombinations to come about occurs in the PI animal, not in the vaccines. In vaccines, the viruses are grown separately and then combined right before vaccination. So what we have in the bottle, those viruses were combined when they went in the bottle. So they really haven't had the opportunity to interact. And once they get into the animal's immune system is going to be eliminating them fairly quickly. So the opportunity's not there. The other thing is that there's not going to be a selection process. So far, the recombinations we've seen, there's a high natural selection for cytopathic virus in persistently infected animals that are going to go into mucosal disease. That's where cytopathic viruses come from. So that happens. So theoretically, it could happen. The reality is it's not going to happen. There's the opportunity and the selection is not there. So I guess one way to explain it is theoretically I could win the Miss Universe prize. I do have everything that Miss Universe would have. The probability of me becoming Miss Universe are really pretty remote at this point. Okay? Don't laugh so hard, guys. You guys want to comment on that?
I guess I would just concur totally with that. Some people have asked me, well, what if we vaccinate, PI animals in a feedlot, and what's the chances that that vaccine then recombines with that non-cytopathic virus that's in there? And I tell them, well, in most feedlots, there's so much virus floating around anyway, that recombination has just as much chance to go on anyway. So I don't think it's an issue at all. I really don't.
I was wondering on the herds that you've seen that have been tested, as far as the amount of PIs by geography, do you see any trends in the numbers of PIs being found by geographic region? If so, can you expand on that?
Very good question. The best answer is we just have not done enough of the survey work to really make a very concrete decision. Based on what we have seen so far, the answer is there is no discernible trend. Now, you can tell a couple of stories. You can say, well, in the South, people cattle are a lot more densely populated, a lot fewer acres per cow. Probably we have a higher prevalence there. Or you can make the story that out west, they're spread out a lot more. The PIs are more likely to live longer because they're not under other husbandry stresses, so the prevalence ought to be higher out there. So far, with limited prevalence studies done to date, we haven't seen anything, as far as I'm aware of, as far as a geographic prevalence. So you could spin a story any way you want, almost, and make it plausible. So far, the data is not. Well, first of all, the data so far is there hasn't been anything, but there hasn't been any indications of a geographic difference in prevalence. But I'll follow that by saying we just haven't done that much prevalence surveys to really say very strongly.
Would you guess that it'd be more related to management and production system than region origin?
Dr. Ripp, I ask if it's more in more a relationship with management. Probably so in that a couple of things, and again, it's a little bit frustrating then to tell a good story because probably a place where I'd expect to see it is where there's just no management and I'm circulating and I'm allowing a low-grade percentage of PIs in a herd all the time. The other place we might see it, though, is in animals that are really well taken care of. Because, again, the PI animals die, usually, except for my girl up here, usually the first time you really stress them is when they're likely to die. If that occurs shortly after birth, at weaning, at trucking, is some event usually begins the process of them then going ahead and dying. Well, what if it's a replacement heifer and I keep her on my place and I baby her and I feed her well and she's never really stressful? I expect her to live much longer. So my problem, I think it is management related, but again, it puts into more than one story. And so... I would concur with that. There you go. Amen.
This is for Dr. Grooms. You talked about the wish list of having the vaccinations done prior to breeding, but the reality is we don't have the cattle in the corral. So has any work been done comparing vaccination, or I guess I should say performance over a long time, at doing the vaccinations, say, at preg checking versus at branding when we do have the cattle in the corral? And anybody else jump in?
Sure. And I certainly concur with the comment, and I understand that managing cattle prior to breeding is not ideal. That was the ideal situation. If we can do it, great. If we can't, then we need to look at other things. So the answer is I am not aware of studies that have looked at vaccination at branding versus at weaning in the fall if you're a spring calving operation. But that's certainly in my view better than nothing. Okay, that's certainly better than nothing. It's not the ideal situation because we're not stimulating immunity right prior to when that fetus is at most at risk. Okay, and so those are some studies that probably need to be done. And if anybody's got money, we'll be glad to do them. No problem at all.
Do you know if any work has been done on vaccinating at branding, the theoretically pregnant cow? Right, say probably 30 to 60 days,
right? Not that I'm aware of. And if there's some stuff out there, I'd like to see it, but I'm not aware of it, in all honesty. Anybody else out there seen anything?
Not in regard to fetal protection, no.
So the recommendation prior to breeding is purely a theoretical one, and it makes sense, okay? But maybe we can get away with that branding and do just as good a job, but that's something that's not been done. You know, my fear then would be, you know, then it's not as easy to use a modified live vaccine, which, as we've kind of all been saying, is we think does a better job of stimulating immunity. There are some modified live vaccines out there that are approved for use in pregnant cows, but... You know, there's some stipulations with using that in those pregnant cows if you read the label. So it may not still be the ideal time to vaccinate cows and get the best immunity that we want.
Along those lines, when we were doing the BRSV research, we found that if we would vaccinate pregnant cows second trimester with a modified live BRSV, we reduced in the vaccinated half, we reduced clinical BVD in the neonates. Clear up into the feedlot phase. One question, Dr. Grooms.
Just to kind of reiterate your statement, I understand what you're doing there is you're improving cluster immunity to that when that calf is born, and that there's certainly a benefit to that. And that's why when I put up my vaccine, that was a starting place. And if I was trying to do other things to improve the health of that calf by improving cluster immunity, I may come back in the winter or in the second trimester, third trimester, and hit them with another vaccine.
Yeah. Dr. Merlin Fry, who isolated the BRSV for me the very first time, when I noticed this, he said that we were mutating intrauterine non-cytopathic to cytopathic, and that's the reason we weren't seeing the kid born with BVD. Dr. Steve Bowen said that wasn't what was happening. He agreed that we were doing something positive, but didn't know what. Looking at your charts on all the various vaccines, we have programs now that we're using that are using three or even four doses of vaccine. We're using all modified lives. We started, you didn't mention anything about a branding age vaccination. We've improved our summer health in a controlled studies by doing that. Also, would you change using various vaccines? Companies' vaccines and a program like that.
Again, That was my starting place, okay? And I want to reiterate that. And depending on the farm, the management program, so forth, we may add a branding age vaccine like you mentioned. So the question is, one of the strategies is actually change vaccines or rotate them so that we are increasing the antigenic exposure, because one vaccine company or one pharmaceutical company's vaccine may have one strain of BVD and another strain. I don't have a problem with that. And you know, how often you rotate that's totally up to you. But I have no problem with rotating vaccines to broaden the diversity that your animals are being exposed to over time. And we certainly have recommended that in farms, especially if they're high-risk farms that have a high risk of bringing, you know, different virus strains into their operation. They're open herd, you know, they're commingled, you know, cows on common grazing ground, whatever, you name it. That's a place where we want to broaden that protection as much as possible.
If I could just add to that, though, changing vaccine companies isn't necessarily going to change vaccine strains. A lot of the companies actually go out, or not a lot, some of the companies actually go out and isolate the vaccines from the competitors and they put it into their vaccine. So just changing, nothing has to be a big consumer, and that's why the slides Dr. Grimms put up are helpful. You have to know what's in the vaccine. And the other thing that sometimes happens is companies is they use the same strain and change the name slightly. So what we're going to try to keep doing now, and first generated some of the information on that slide about a year and a half ago, is we're going to try to go in and look at the vaccine strains every couple of years, ask the companies to send them to us, we'll sequence them and we'll compare them, so U.S. consumers will know what's in those vaccines.
I had a question for Dr. Larson. You commented, if I were a stalker operator, it would be really good if I could purchase all PI-tested negative calves. Would you care to speculate that on the other hand, sellers might pose some resistance in regard to cost and all of doing that? Would you care to speculate if you think certain status, high-risk, low-risk kinds of status due to biosecurity standards and testing might provide confidence to buyers at some point that their cattle are low risk or are free of PI, other than testing all the calves?
Right. Again, I think it's going to be interesting. We live in exciting times, and as we move into more and more integration of the information around cattle, so that if I'm a feedlot operator or a cow-calf guy, if I know more about the life history of that herd, in other words, if already in some alliances and those kinds of things where we're keeping track of information from feeder back to the cow-calf man, again, I almost include it as part of my screening. If the feedlot that I have a relationship with is notching all the chronics and deads, and they're never finding it in my cattle that are chronics or deads, I'm going to feel pretty good that I'm sending low-risk cattle. Because, again, that's a high-risk population. And if I never find it there, and if I, and again, if the rest of my history works too, they didn't just die at my place and then I sent the non-PIs. Again, so I start to include that in all of my information. Now, from a negotiation standpoint, from a price standpoint, then it's how well can you negotiate, how well can you document that you truly are low-risk. But I think that's where we're moving to in the cattle industry, much more descriptive of the herds that we work with. I think it's a great opportunity for cow-calf guys that want to do that kind of follow-up, working with the feeder, whether they own the cattle or not, and keeping track of that information, and it becomes of value. Now, I'm not going to get up here and tell you how many dollars that is, but it becomes of value when you reduce the risk to your purchaser, or if you're retaining ownership, you're reducing your own risk. So I do see the way the cattle industry is evolving. We're going to be talking a lot more about several years duration, including data from people that buy our cattle, not just our own data. So I think that's definitely going to occur. I have a hard time putting a value on that. The other side of that is if I am a stalker operator or a feedlot and I'm buying some cattle that are all screen negative, that very well could be that fight farm had a problem a year or two ago, and this is part of their control to make sure that they completely stamped it out. And it's an additional way for the cow-calf guy to get a little bit more money. They're making money on their calf herd by getting this virus out of there. Now, if I can recoup another couple of bucks on the sale price, that's just gravy. So, from a calf standpoint, if I'm doing it, I might as well sell it. I might as well go to effort to try to market the fact that I've done this work. So I kind of walked around that question a little bit, but I hope I answered what you were asking, Dale.
Very good. Thank you.
I had a quick question for Dr. Greens. You showed some interesting data, feedlot data, and vaccinating calves on arrival and the protection you gave. Did you say if it was modified live or killed, and did you use one vaccination or booster?
In that trial that I showed you, that was a modified live type 1 vaccine. They were boostered 21 days after they arrived at the feedlot. They were exposed to both a type 1 and a type 2 PI animal throughout the feeding period. So that's the bottom line. Hopefully that'll be written up here very soon and you can read the whole story.
Well, very good. We are out of time. And really appreciate all of your attention this morning. I think it was an excellent session. A couple of housekeeping things. Please fill out the survey. And the other thing is, when you go out the door for lunch in the lunch program, turn left. Let's give all the speakers a good hand.